Following program are pre-recorded.
Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Super Talk 1270, you're tuned to Talk of the Town. I'm Steve Bach, along with Kevin Oberlander, Dakota Pharmacy, International Health Center, downtown Bismarck's Corner Drugstore, and Jeff, pharmacist as well, joining us this morning. Okay.
Yeah.
This is kind of a, when you were telling me about his experience running a little triathlon down in Arizona, and then you're like, hey, we should have him on and talk about it. I'm like, yeah, that's a good idea. And then as this has evolved a little bit, it's kind of turned into, and I know you, Kevin.
Yeah.
This is your version of a gotcha moment because this is funny.
It is. I felt sorry for him.
How long?
He got back on Tuesday, and I felt sorry for him for a while because he couldn't even tie his shoes. And that's not because he couldn't bend over. His feet could not handle a tied shoelace.
So. Wow. All right.
Jeff, Triathlon, Arizona.
Okay. You are the fitness guru guy and the triathlon. I'm like, okay, why was, tell us the thought process of, okay, I'm going to go do this triathlon down in Arizona and the thought process, the training process that goes into that. Cause, you know, I have April Lund on, and she does amazing running things. It's like, triathlons are a little different. That's a different animal.
And it was an Ironman.
Okay, so, now it's a triathlon on steroids.
So Ironman Arizona, which was on November, I think it was 17th. And so everybody's like, why did you want to do that? And
yeah, why?
It's a good question. I think it goes back to when I was a kid. I grew up, my dad was an endurance athlete, ran marathons, did Olympic distance triathlons, did a bunch of cycling, did a bunch of running, winter biathlon. So I kind of grew up in that endurance sport environment. I ran cross country as a kid. And I remember watching the Ironman triathlon, ABC's Wide World of Sports, right? I mean, we all remember the
events. Oh, yeah.
And I remember watching that thinking, this is just incredible. Like, to be able to push your body to that limit. And growing up, I always wanted to do a triathlon, whether it be a sprint distance, you know, whatever. And I just never could wrap my head around being efficient enough to swim or being disciplined enough to teach myself how to swim, you know. And so it was always one of these things that, like, I wanted to do but just never really could swim well enough to do it or feel confident enough to do it. And so in May of 2023, I tore my distal bicep tendon in my dominant arm, my left arm, which for me was kind of the first real injury I've ever had in my life. Like, real substantial. I mean, I've had injuries, but it's like a couple weeks here, a couple weeks there, you're fine, right?
Yeah, dings.
Yeah. And so, and I remember reading about, looking about, like, okay, what's my next step? And they're like, well, this is real common in middle-aged men.
All right, that's where it went off the rails.
Yeah.
As soon as you said, oh, middle, wait a minute. Reality check here, right?
So here I am, you know, like, realizing, I guess I'm middle-aged. And a lot of the training I'd been doing up until that point was off the table. Like, I was going to be in a brace and a sling for the, you know, after surgery for at least 12 weeks. And they told me, you won't probably gain full strength and functionality back in that arm for a year. And so I was like, well, everything I was doing up to that point was lifting weights, stuff like that. So I was like, I need to refocus on what I need to do, you know, what I want to do for training. And I think, you know, this might be the time where I really take a shot at this, completing a triathlon. That was my initial goal. And during this whole time, I was reading a book at the time called The Comfort Crisis by Michael Easter. And he talks about how society has gotten really, it's gotten too convenient, too easy for society. You know, everything's just kind of planned.
We're not pushed.
Yeah. Essentially, we don't do hard things. And he talks about a concept, a Japanese concept called Masoji, which is what, and his Masoji is like, pick something really, really hard. And there's two rules. One, it needs to be really, really hard. Two, don't die. And
well, you can't set the bar any lower, I guess.
and he talks about when you make it really hard, make it where you have a really good chance of failing. Like, you have a very good chance of failing. It's not something like, oh, if something happens, I might not do well. But make it so you might fail. And you have to work really, really hard at it. And so I was reading this book at the time, and I'm like, I need to take a run at a triathlon. You know, initially it was a triathlon because I couldn't swim more than 100 meters without feeling like I was going to die.
So this is your first triathlon.
The Ironman was not my first. It was my second.
Second.
Yeah, but not my first rodeo. It was my second.
First Ironman, though.
First Ironman, yes.
And for those that don't know, differentiate what a triathlon is versus an Ironman triathlon.
Well, so there's all kinds of different disciplines in our triathlon. There's a sprint distance, which usually has like a 500 to 750 meter swim, about a 12-mile bike, 6-mile or a 3-mile run. There's Olympic distance, which usually goes to a 1-mile run, about 25-mile bike, and probably like a 10K. Then there's a half Ironman, which is 2-mile swim, 56-mile bike, and 13.1 mile run. So it's a half marathon. And then the full distance Ironman is a 2.4 mile swim, 112 mile bike, and a 26.2 marathon at the end. So my initial goal was just to finish the sprint. Like, this is going to be hard enough for me initially because of this, like me imagining myself swimming 700, and I did the Bismarck Triathlon here in June, which phenomenal event. I think they run it very, very well. If anybody's considering doing a triathlon, that would be one to start. I think it's great. But that swim was 750 meters.
So where do you swim down in Arizona?
You swim in Tempe Town Lake.
Okay.
Which?
Because people think Ironman, yep, and the first thing you think about Hawaii, Kona.
Hawaii.
You know, that's
quintessential.
That's the Ironman. And I could imagine myself swimming that going, don't get eaten by shark. Don't get eaten by shark. Okay. Not in Tempe Town Lake.
No, there's Ironmans all over the country, all over the world. You know, they run Ironman. The company that runs Ironman is just huge. They run half Ironmans all year long.
It's a global business.
Huge, huge global business. And so, you know, for me, it was just finishing a triathlon. So I made it a goal to do the Bismarck Triathlon. And I remember my parents came out to watch me. I have to laugh at this. My dad's like, I'm going to put your mom at the bike turnaround. I'm like, why the hell are you going to put her way out there? He's like, well, I don't want her to see her. You're drowned. And I think he was partly serious in it. I'm like, I'll be all right. Like, and I swam. I'd been able to swim, you know, 1,000 meters in the pool. I felt fairly confident I could suffer through a sprint triathlon. Well,
that's an interesting way to put it, is suffer through.
Yeah.
Because that has to kind of be your mindset, right?
For me, for my first one, yeah, it was absolutely. Unless you're a swimmer in high school or you're a really strong swimmer, for me, it's a survive, bike, and run.
Please don't drown. Please don't drown.
Yeah.
Please don't, yeah.
And you know, and it took me, in the pool, I was swimming 16, 17 minutes for 750. You get in that open water, you get in there surrounded by a bunch of people, and everything goes out the window. I think I side-stroked that whole 750 meters. It took me 22 minutes to get out of the water. My dad said, you weren't last, but you were really close. And I'm like, yeah. But what makes up for it is I'm actually a pretty strong cyclist. And so I passed like 25 or 30 people on that first.
All right, hold that thought. Sure. We don't want to come back to that. We're talking with Jeff from Dakota Pharmacy, Dakota Natural Health Center, Kevin Oberlander as well. We're talking about the methodology of going into doing your first Ironman triathlon. And how long would that take you to get out of the water dog paddling, Kevin?
Actually, I'm a pretty good swimmer.
Are you?
Yep. Okay. Years ago, I did a triathlon.
Did you really?
In Devil's Lake. Yep. And I came out of the water.
Okay,
way
Devil's
out.
Lake doesn't count because if it's in the fall, you can walk across it on the plankton.
It was in the summer.
On the algae.
I came out close to the lead in the swim, but that was the end
of
it.
That was, okay.
Yeah.
We're talking.
I finished.
We're talking about fitness and training this morning is what the focus is. This is Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Super Talk. Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Super Doc 1270, you're tuned to Talk of the Town. I'm Steve Bach, along with Kevin Oberlander, Dakota Pharmacy, Dakota Natural Health Center, downtown Bismarck's Corner Drugstore. Also, pharmacist Jeff with us in the studio, talking about his first Ironman triathlon and his second triathlon. Okay, the good news is you didn't drown.
Yep, the good news is didn't drown.
But we're talking a little bit during the break about the mental aspect, and I've got a bunch of friends that have done triathlons and Ironman, friends in Hawaii, and 201 of them, and all asked separately, and just in conversation, and they've all kind of come up with the same answer. Getting your mind right for the swimming part is the hardest part of a triathlon. getting your mind right for the swimming part actually doesn't start with swimming. They've all said it's like, I learned to float for hours because you and I were talking during the break and you're stuck in the water with your own head.
Yeah.
It's just you and in your head and you got to have your mind right for that. And they're like, their training always starts with the fact that I'm not going to drown. We're fine.
Yeah.
And that's where it starts.
Yeah. I think that was the game. Realizing that for me. So I think it was part of the problem where it took me so long to complete this was because, or to realize I can do this was, I'm going to float if I stop swimming.
Yeah, I'm not going
to
drown.
I used to have this mentality where if I'm not kicking 500 miles an hour and paddling as hard as I can, I'm going to sink to the bottom. And you're like, so for me, learning how to float, and like I was saying, thank God for the internet that has all these videos and coaching tips and stuff that kind of you realize that, you know, this isn't as hard as it you make it out to be.
It's kind of like that Lieutenant Dan moment in Forrest Gump when he finds God and, oh, hey, he's just like floating out in the ocean and yep. in the Gulf. And,
so,
and it was easy. Now, you have done triathlons, Kevin.
Yeah.
And you're actually a good swimmer.
I'm a very good swimmer.
You're good on the swimming side.
Yep. So when Jeff was training for the Bismarck Triathlon.
Did you give me a tip?
Well, no, but he used to Don't leave drown. At night saying, I'm going out to do some swimming. I hope I don't drown. So when I'd get there the next morning, I'm like, yes, Jeff didn't drown. He made it.
But he learned to float.
I just learned to swim more relaxed, essentially. So yeah, I finished the Bismarck Triathlon. It went about as well as I expected. You know, once I got through the swim, I'm like, all right, I'm going to finish this. And, you know, and I've done a lot of cycling, so the bike was about what I thought it was going to be. In the run, it was kind of like I'm holding back a little bit on the bike because I'm like, all right, the run's coming up. It's only a 5K, but yet I don't know how I'm going to feel. I've never done this before. Felt great on the bike. So, but like I said, that was my experience with the first sprint triathlon.
So and swim was the first part, right?
Yeah, swim, bike, run. And I was just, when I finished, I was like, all right, like I finished my goal as being finishing a triathlon. And I was super happy with myself, you know, I was like, I can do this. And so this was right at the court towards the end of June. And I was like, all right, if I'm going to make a run at this Ironman, I'm going to make a run at it. So about a week later, I hired an online coach, told him this is so right before 4th of July. I was like, hired an online coach, gave me a training plan. He's like, well, which one do you want to do? I said, well, hopefully in the next year. I said, you know, my goal was to do it in 2024, but if I said, I'd like to do it by the end of this year, 2024. And he's like, whoa, hold on.
he starts giggling on the other end of the phone.
Yeah. He goes, hold on. He goes, a lot of people look, and this was 5 months. So last Ironman distance, full distance is, well, one's in Cozumel, Mexico, which is the end of November. Then there's one in Arizona, and then there's one in Florida right at the beginning of November. So my initial goal was Florida, Ironman Florida, and a couple of reasons. One, I could possibly wear a wetsuit depending on the water temperature, and two, it was an ocean swim. So I'm like, I'm going to float really well in the ocean. It's going to make it a lot better.
Do they have a triathlon at the Great Salt Lake?
Yeah, no kidding, right? And so he's like, well, most people consider a marathon in 6 months to be hard. And I'm like, well, I've run some marathons. I've done some endurance events. I've done some, you know, like 65-mile-plus adventure races in my life. I said, I'm not a stranger to, like, suffering for a long time.
Yeah, well, my wife does half marathons, and she's done marathons. And her training regime is minimum 3 months to get ready for any of those longer-distance races.
Yeah, so he's like, well, I'll drop
your training. 5 months.
5 months.
For a triathlon.
Yeah, to really learn how to swim 2.4 miles.
Wow.
And he's like, I'll draw you up a training plan, but he goes, you need to seriously look at this. And I told him, like, I have kids that play travel soccer. I have this. I have a full-time job. All this stuff. And he's like, well, I'll draw you up a training plan, but you need to seriously take a look at it and see if he goes, because you're going to need to hit almost all your workouts. And I'm like, I get it. Like, this is going to be hard. So he drew it up, throws it out to me. You know, the first couple weeks I'm looking at, it's like 7 or 8 hours a week. And I'm like, over 6 days. You know, it was 6 days a week, one day off a week. the first couple weeks were like 6 or 7 hours, and then the wheels fell off. It was like 10, 12, 15, 16. And I was doing
it becomes a full-time job.
It becomes, you know, you're averaging 2 to 3 extra hours a day. Most of those are coming on Saturday and Sunday. But, you know, you're looking at it. For me, he did a three-week on, 1 week off. So, like, I gradually build over 3 weeks, and then I have a lower volume week. I never really had a full week off. So, like, towards the end, those training volumes, you know, you're in the pool. And I was doing a beginner track. I told him, I just want to finish. My goal is to finish 12 to 14 hours. He's like,
all right. Not drown.
Yeah, and not drown. He's like, all right. So he put me on a beginner training program. Because I was over 45, I think he said, I'll put you on a master's one. You get a little more rest. I'm like, good.
Because he's middle-aged.
And I said, master's is good. That way I don't want to go in there all beat up. I don't want to go in there or injure myself and not be able to even complete it. So
yeah, the worst thing would be you get injured during training and not be able to do it.
So you have these 3 week buildups, and the third week is usually towards the end. I mean, those were like 15, 16 hour weeks. And, you know, most of my workouts during the week with my job, it was like an hour, hour and a half. But on the weekends, it would be 5.5 hour bike, 2.5 hour run, 3 hour run. And those are happening on Saturday and Sunday. And I can't tell you how many times you're at one of your kids' soccer games. You get home at 9:30. I'm like, all right, I got to go run for 2.5 hours. And so you're running at midnight.
So anybody complaining about getting up and going to the gym in the morning, or, you know, long day at work and going to the gym afterwards? Just calm that right now.
Yeah. You know, I had a little bit of a front row seat because he would leave at night after working, and I knew he was heading out to do some lengthy training, and he would comment. He'd make a comment, or I could see it was getting old. It was wearing pretty
thin. Really starts. It does, and it wears on your family. I mean, like it's tough. It's a lot of commitment, and you try. And me, my whole goal was I don't want this to affect my personal
life. All right, I want to talk about the mental aspect of getting the mind right for getting into the training through the competition, because we've been talking about the physical side of the training, but the mental part is probably just as big, if not bigger. And then, of course, the nutritional side of training for this and participating in a triathlon, let alone an Ironman triathlon. I'm Steve Bakken, along with Jeff, pharmacist over at Dakota Pharmacy, Kevin Oberlander, Dakota Pharmacy, Dakota Natural Health Center, downtown Bismarck's Corner Drugstore. This is Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Don't miss a minute on Hannity Show.
I know that there is a segment of society that would love a perpetual shutdown, and I guess we can live in a bubble, but who's going to build the bubble if everybody shuts down?
Weekday afternoon starting at 2 on Super Talk 1270. Welcome back to Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Super Talk 1270, you're tuned to Talk of the Town. I'm Steve Bakken, along with Kevin Oberlander, Dakota Pharmacy, Dakota Natural Health Center, downtown Bismarck's Corner Drugstore. We're talking with Jeff, who just completed an Ironman triathlon down in Arizona. And we're talking a little bit about the training and the preparation and the things that go into a triathlon, let alone an Ironman triathlon. And, okay, Jeff, I want to talk about the mental health aspect of this, because getting your mind right, we talked a little bit about it on the swimming portion, but there's a ramp up for not only the physical side of training, but you have to start preparing mentally. And in your case, it takes a village. I mean, family and everybody's got to participate.
Yeah. If you don't have your family or
you need
the
support,
your support staff, it's going to be hard. Man, it's just a grind. The training is an absolute grind. Especially if you're trying to, like, still go to your kids' sporting events, still, you know, get up and go to work. It's a grind every day. And it's, some mornings it's 4:30, 5 a.m. Some days it's 10:30 at night.
So for your kids' soccer practice, you go there and just do laps around the soccer field while they're practicing?
Well, there's been a few. I've done a few runs in between softball games. Like, they'd have the softball game hour and a half. They'd have another one. So I just ran down there around Cottonwood Park. But, yeah, my poor kids are like, oh, my dad's crazy. He's out there.
But that mental part, we hear so much about mental health nowadays. And
well, if you're doing an Ironman triathlon, your mental health is already shot.
Well, okay. Fair enough. I think it starts with knowing better, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. but the preparation that goes into, because there's two, and maybe there's more, two segments of that mental health of getting your mind right for the preparation. So through the training regimen, which is grueling enough, but then the race itself, that's a different mental mindset.
Yeah, and it's funny because I don't run or bike with headphones. I have, you know, maybe I'm just too old for that. You know, that's just not. And one reason why
they have this thing called Bluetooth now.
Yeah, I know.
I know you're middle aged.
Yeah, middle aged. But a lot of that started to come from you can't wear them in a lot of these events. And so, like, if you're going to swim for an hour and a half,
you practice in.
You need to the practice state without that you're gonna running because yeah. without headphones, like people are like I can never run with headphones. But like you're running for 4 or 5 hours. You're running without headphones. You're in your own headspace. You're, and the training. So for me, it was vital to not train with headphones and just to be in that mental space to, you know, hey, this hurts. You know, you're going to have to work through this. But in training for me, it was like, it was hard. Some days you're like, I got to get up. I got to do this. You don't feel like doing this, but really this was a goal for so long for me, you know, since I was a little kid, like, to hear those words, you are an Iron Man, is like, there's just, it's, I mean, it still gives me chills, but like to hear that, to finish that goal, that's what really drove me. Like, get up. And I mean, my people are like, do you have to go now? Like, I'm like, yeah, we're just sitting around here doing nothing. Like, this is a good time for me to do it. I'm not missing anything. So it gets to be a real grind. I mean, you come to work on my, it's like, what'd you do this weekend? I worked out. I rode, you know, I ran or rode bike for 10 hours this weekend. And it's just like, like Kevin said, towards the end of it, I was ready. Like the last 2 or 3 weeks, I'm just like, I'm just done. I just want to get this race over with. I'm just tired. And okay. I just tired of the just constant drain, the constant.
Yeah, it's just a grind.
It's a real grind. So that, but that mental toughness in training that you develop in training carries you through that.
Okay. Day. So let's move on to the race portion. And how does that mindset, that mental component switch?
Everybody always said that the race is a reward for all the training, right? You're thinking,
yeah, here's the cherry on top. Of yeah.
You're like, right. Whatever.
Losing yeah. toenails is the reward.
We'll get to that next segment.
A really, really long day is your reward. Oh, yeah, that sounds great. But so I went down to Arizona about 4 or 5 days before the race. So, and part of that was to, if I had any problems with it, my bike getting down there. My parents lived down there in the winter, so I was able to stay with them, and they transported me around. And so it just worked out so well for me to go down
you
early.
You go walk the course? Are you allowed
you
to
go
do
down,
the course?
You can, we drove the bike course. It's all, you know, we drove the bike course, had a good idea of the run course. Swim, you just stand there and look down the river, and you're like, that's a long ways away. And it's Tempe Town Lake, which everybody's like, oh, that's a little suspect. And it was, I mean, it's not, it's funny because
you have all your shots before you wet. Yeah.
And get your tetanus. Which is really funny because somebody was holding up a sign in the run that said, you survived Tempe Town Lake. The fish can't even do that. I thought it was the best one. And so, yeah, you go down, you get your registration, you go to, there's a mandatory athlete briefing. You kind of absorb all the Ironman environment, which is, I mean, they do this. This is first class operation, very, very big. I think there were 1,700 athletes that entered the water on that day. And
did 1,700 come out? That's cool.
Yeah,
it is Tempe Town Lake.
Yeah, I might have missed one or two. But so I was down there just to kind of get my head right, feel comfortable, rest. And so a lot of those first early days before the race, it was like, you know, just like there was a little bit of self doubt. There was a little bit, but then you kind of, you're like, you've done this. You've done these distances. You've never done them all in one day, but you've done these different distances. You just kind of like.
Do you have to compartmentalize it and kind of go, okay, I got to do this,
which
is the swim, and then I got to do the bike, and that's change your mindset for that. And then now I'm going to do the run and change your mindset for that. You kind of separate those?
To me, it was one discipline at a time. Like swim was going to be, I always told myself, if I can get out, so you have time limits. So in the swim, you have 2 hours and 20 minutes to complete it. And I was like, in training, I could always swim that distance in about 1 hour and 20 minutes. And so I'm like, all right, give myself an extra 20 minutes because one of the chaos of jumping in the water was a bunch of people, swimming with a bunch of people, no line on the bottom of the lake to follow. You know, and so I say, if I can do the swim in an hour 30 to an hour 40, I'm good. So I wasn't super concerned about the time cap, but like I took it one discipline at a time. And then the bike is like, all right, it's 112 miles. It's going to be a long grind. And I knew the course, so I felt pretty, we had driven it. And so, and I had talked to, there's a gentleman here in town that I got to, had the ability to meet and was very fortunate to meet that did it the year before. And we sat down for about an hour and he kind of told me, you know, what he went through, what the course was like, what his experience was. And he's a very good triathlete, you know, very. And so I took, that helped a ton. So, it was, for me, it's just compartmentalizing each event. You know, the swim was by far my big concern. It's just like everybody's is, it does that far.
Okay. We're coming up against the break, but I want to touch on one other mental health aspect of this. Now you're done. Is it the mental letdown, relief? What's the feeling you get from a mental capacity when you're finished with the race? Or does it take a while to process that?
Immediately finishing or like a week later?
Both.
Immediately, it's this huge emotional high. Like, it's like this, like, I can't even really describe it, but like this. For me, it was a 6 month training. For some people, they do it for a year, 2 years. And so for me, it was like everything I did, every hard thing I did in the last 6 months, getting up, going training, not doing the want to do this, all culminates in this moment right here on the Ironman red carpet. And there's, it was amazing.
We'll find out about the, after you've compartmentalized and decompressed a little bit, the mental state. When we come back, we're talking with Jeff, pharmacist over at Dakota Pharmacy. Just did the marathon, the triathlon, the Ironman triathlon down in Arizona, which is phenomenal for anybody who's not looked into a triathlon. It's probably the pinnacle of athletic prowess for, well, for a lot of people that are not professionals and trying to get a gold medal. And those guys that do the gold medal, it's like, whoa. Kevin Oberlander, Dakota Pharmacy, Dakota Natural Health Center. This is Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Super Talk. Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Super Talk 1270, you're tuned to Talk of the Town. I'm Steve Bakken along with Kevin Oberlander, Dakota Pharmacy, Dakota Natural Health Center, downtown Bismarck's corner drugstore. I really haven't said a whole lot today.
I'm very comfortable with that.
Yeah, I know. And we've got Jeff, pharmacist over at Dakota Pharmacy, and with us as well, who just completed an Ironman triathlon down in Arizona. Okay, so the mental health side, after you've processed for a week or so, what's the mental state of a triathlon athlete, in your case, you?
I have a comment.
Okay.
So I wanted Jeff to send some pictures, which he did, and we posted on social media. And the last picture is him on the medal stand with his medal around his neck, and he's got this big, big smile on it.
Lifted at that point.
This big smile on his face, and I'm like, well, he used every muscle in his body but his smile muscles because he can still smile.
That's about it, too, isn't it?
Yeah, it was the most physically exhausted I've ever been.
And mental exhaustion.
Yeah, there was a few times I threw the banana rind instead of threw the banana in the garbage instead of the rind and tried to eat the rind on the marathon. But yeah, it's, you know, a couple days post race. Initially, like the first day post race, getting on the airplane, you're like, I don't think I could ever do this again. Like you're just beat. You're like everything hurts, and then. Next day, it's like, oh, it's not so bad. The next day, you're like, yeah, I probably didn't do that again. And it's funny because I was told that I need to get approval at home before I sign up.
Well, yeah, it's that support network.
And I still haven't gotten that approval. Okay.
Well, Christmas is
so, yeah,
we'll see what you
looking get back on it, you know, once everything kind of heals and once everything, you look back at that. And somebody gave me a great piece of advice at the start of the swim, and I wish I could have really understood the advice at the time. He said, enjoy it. He goes, this is your first one. He goes, enjoy it. Because one, this will only ever be your first one. And two, if you ever do another one, you're going to try and beat this time. And he was 100% correct. And they talk about the race being the reward. It 100% is. The environment, the people, the support staff is, the environment's just amazing. And you're in the marathon, you're you eventually start walking and running with the same, you know, for me, it was a walking and running. Some people can run the whole thing. I can't. But you're walking and running with the same people for an hour and a half. You know, they pass you, you pass them, you sit there and chit chat a little bit while you walk. See, you know, just
kind of slide into your group, your peers.
Yeah. And it's the environment is great. And the probably the best feeling is when you turn, for those of you who don't know, there's a huge carpet with Iron Man symbols and they announce your name. There's fireworks. And that moment going down that carpet, I wish I would have kind of slowed down, maybe even walked it. But at the point, you're just like, I just want to be done. I'm exhausted. Because that moment, you'll never get that first
moment. Well, you film the whole thing with your GoPro, right?
So. Yeah, they actually do a great job. I have tons of videos of me come down it. You know, they announce, you know, your name, you are an Iron Man, and that just gives you chills.
That's cool.
It really is.
Talk about the nutritional side, because you're big into nutrition.
Yeah,
so what did you have to change with your nutritional regime leading up through the training into the Iron Man?
So the big thing, I didn't really change my diet a ton, as far as like what I was eating. Some days I swear I ate everything that got in front of me, which, I mean, because there's days where it's a 2,000 calorie day that you're burning, you know, 1,000 calories.
One more bite.
And so I didn't change, as far as like the types of food I was eating, I didn't change a ton. The big thing was nutrition during training and during the race. That's huge. So rough, when they say in an environment like that or in a race like that, you should be consuming, a lot of people, 80 to 100 grams of carbs per hour. And during the race, you know, it's so well supported. There's gels, there's bananas, there's fruit. So a lot of that's coming from gels. And most of my nutrition for me came on the bike. And, you know, and they say that's the fourth discipline of full distance triathlons, is because if you don't get your nutrition right, if you start throwing up everything you've eaten or you're not fueling enough, you're not going to finish. And so for me, it was 80 to 100 grams of carbs per hour, and you had to work up to that into the training. Like, your stomach can't handle that. Like, if you'd go and eat 100 grams of carbs per hour for the next 12 hours, you'd be throwing up left and right. So it took me some time to build that up, and I you look at what Ironman provides on the race, and I trained with what they provide. I bought it, and like, this is what they're going to give me race day, this is what I'm going to train with, because you don't want to introduce anything new. And so the bike, so I took a 100 calorie or 25 grams of carbs with 100 milligrams of caffeine gel right before the start of the swim, and then another 80 gram carb gel right behind it. So I had 105 grams of carbs for the swim, because, you know, and I'm like, this is what's going to fuel me through the swim. And the swim took me an hour and 50 minutes. So it was a little bit longer than I thought it was going to, but the water temperature was 60 degrees. So it was a lot colder than we thought it was going to be, and just the chaos of dealing with all the people around you and stuff. So that was my start of the swim, was 105 grams. And so I got out of the swim, felt pretty good. And then on the bike, it was about 80 to 100 grams of carbs, whether it's a gel, a bar, or in a liquid form. I had it on my bike. I had it planned.
But you have to manage that, because too much is not good. Too little is too
much. Yeah, as long as your stomach handles what you can. And then coming off the bike, my fueling plan went really well. Coming off the bike, I was really sick of gels. And so when I hit the first aid station, so I told myself, I've done bananas in training. So I went with about a half a banana every mile for 26 miles.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but all in all, my nutrition went really, really well. I did talk to one lady at mile 18 that she said she'd been throwing everything up since about mile 6.
Yeah, that's got to be brutal.
I feel bad for those people, but my nutrition went well, and I was really happy with it. But, yeah, it's just loading up the carbs.
We're coming up against the break, but I want to spend a couple minutes talking about something you've kind of stumbled into because of this experience, and it's sports pharmacy. Explain that to us.
So sports pharmacy is a discipline in pharmacy where a lot of teams are developing, professional teams, Olympic type of teams are developing a pharmacist on staff to help manage banned substance lists, helping optimize supplements for performance, managing prescription medications, whether they're on the banned substance list, stuff like that. And so we kind of stumbled upon this, I don't know, a few months ago, and I started looking into it. And I've met a lot of people that are probably really instrumental in the development of this. And
well, that's been a thing in professional sports for a long time, and it's gotten down into the colleges. It's actually starting to get into the high schools now.
And that's great, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions when it comes to nutrition and supplements in the sports world. A lot of what they call bro science. And I think that's where a sports pharmacy can really benefit teams and athletes and stuff like that. So I've met a lot of these people, and it's been kind of eye-opening. And
well, we can do another show on that. I just wanted to touch on that really quickly, because there's a lot to discuss when it comes to sports pharmacy. So you got the race info and videos up on Serenity University, or where can people find out a little information about your experience?
We posted a little thing on Facebook.
Yeah, right? We did some posting on social media, but I'll meet with our social media marketing gal in a couple of weeks, and we can talk about it.
We're just stopping at Dakota Pharmacy and go, hey, Jeff, how was it? Oh, by the way, one last thing. How many toenails did you lose?
Two as of right now. I lost one at mile 26 of the race, ripped it up. But I lost two, probably lose two more. So we're waiting for them to fall off.
Okay, that's another show in itself.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in today and talking about a great experience, and looking forward to your next triathlon as well.
Yeah.
This is Talk of the Town with Dakota Pharmacy, Dakota Natural Health Center, downtown Bismarck's Corner Drugstore on Super Talk 1270.
Talk of the Town, weekday mornings starting at 9 on Super Talk 1270 and the free Super Talk 1270 mobile app. Mark Mandan, Super Talk 1270. Portions of the following program are pre-recorded. Welcome back to Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Super Talk 1270, you're tuned to Talk of the Town. I'm Steve Bach, along with Dr. Kevin Carls from Essentia Health. And Kevin, thanks for coming in this morning.
Good morning.
Okay, a little background of you. You're a gastrointestinal, GI doctor, and you're actually right here from Bismarck.
Yep, originally grew up in Bismarck, local kid, the oldest of four. Went to school locally here, graduated from University of Mary quite a few years ago.
But they don't have a med school.
That's true. Wound up heading out to UND, where I did grad school and medical school, and then after that, spent a few years out at Mayo Clinic doing internal medicine, and rounded up my training down at Indiana University in Indianapolis.
So when people think of GI, and from a medical perspective, from a biology perspective, that covers a lot of stuff. It really does.
Absolutely.
So when you're looking at being a GI doc, it's top to bottom, isn't it?
Definitely. We do involve the entire digestive tract, and we think of things as the upper and lower. Upper digestive tract, things like acid reflux, difficulty swallowing, our issues with our appetite and fullness and nausea, and really symptoms that come on at the time of eating and so on, and all the way down to our lower digestive tract, dealing with bowel movements, constipation, diarrhea, bloating, bleeding, inflammatory diseases, and even cancer screening and surveillance.
So why GI tract? When you're going to med school and there's a lot on the palate. It's like, okay, I want to pick a specialty.
Yeah.
How'd you get into that?
That's the discussion that goes on internally with all of us as we're going through.
No pun intended.
Exactly. Started out with general internal medicine and really just had a few experiences early on. I noticed I had an interest in the digestive tract, and then it was really first late in medical school where I had a chance to work out at Mayo Clinic for a little while with their gastrointestinal specialists out there, and they really solidified that interest.
Usually it's a doc or a professor or somebody kind of inspires a young student that's looking into a field, or there's a case that kind of triggers them? Is that kind of what happened with you?
Oh, absolutely. And strangely enough, I had actually started out in my third year medical school working with a surgeon here in town that specialized in bariatric surgery for weight loss. And, you know, one of the things they stressed going into that was, we want you to know the digestive tract. We want you to know what happens when we make these changes. We want you to know why this surgery works in the way it does. And I really hit the books looking into this. And it was really there where you start seeing the full spectrum of function of the digestive tract. And it just really stuck with me back then.
So what does a day in the life of a gastroenterologist look like?
You know, it can vary from day to day, but generally we will have at least part of the day that's involved seeing patients in the clinic, talking about problems that they're having and working on solutions. But the other part of the day is in our GI lab, performing procedures, endoscopy, which is really the specialty of the physicians in gastroenterology, making sure that we're looking into the upper and the lower digestive tract, monitoring for precancerous conditions and diseases.
When you're looking at that encompassing piece, and when you've got a patient that presents a case, I'm a big advocate of triad of care, and you have to be your own best advocate. And I always tell people when they're going to a doctor for something that they think is bothering them, you got to be part of your case, because for doctors, and especially with, I can imagine, gastroenterology, you're kind of a sleuth, aren't you? You're kind of putting the pieces together, because what a lot of people don't understand is all these body systems are interconnected. They're intertwined, interwoven, and one thing over here might actually have a cause over here, but it's presenting itself as symptoms in some place entirely different. So you're doing a little sleuth work as a gastroenterology, because it is such a large system of the body that, okay, something here might start way over there.
Absolutely. And it's not just me as the doctor that's the sleuth here. I mean, sometimes a lot of these things involve processes, feelings, symptoms that we have as patients that we may take for granted, just the things that we expect to be normal every day. And this is why one of the things
we become accustomed to, if it's exactly something slow over time, you're like, you don't really notice it. It's not like, oh, I broke my leg and I go to the doctor and get it fixed. It's things that start over time. You have to be aware of that.
Absolutely. And of course, this is the digestive tract. It's never everybody's most fun thing to talk about. Some folks are embarrassed about these types of things, and they sometimes don't know if their expectations are really what things should be like. And this is one of the reasons that we really encourage people. You see something that you think is abnormal, you know, just start writing it down. Watch what's going on a day-to-day basis, and this will help you to recognize some of these patterns in your own body and certainly more effectively communicate them with folks like myself, so that we can really look into this as well as possible and get you the help that you need.
But you got to give the right information for putting the sleuth or the detective on the right path.
Absolutely.
Of figuring something out. How do people do that? I mean, what are some of the things people should look for as signs and symptoms or things that might be a little bit out of the ordinary? Because one of the things that we do in the upper Midwest especially is, I'm not going to see my doctor. I'll tough it out. I'll work through that. But that can lead to a lot of other problems.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know, even just, you know, one of the most common things that I'll see people for are just problems with the bowel movements. You know, I'm stopped up all the time, or you know, I'll be so, you know, constipated one day and belly hurting, or I'll have diarrhea the next. You know, some of these things, you know, honestly, they can vary from day to day based on our diet and fairly minor things, but you start noticing a pattern here where those things that we know are normal just stop being that way. And these are things that we really have to look into more. You know, and we're always telling people, you know, if you start noticing blood coming out anywhere or the stools being black or red, well, that's a fairly obvious thing that folks are going to look for. But there are some of these less specific things with belly pains and so on.
We're talking with Dr. Kevin Carls, gastroenterologist at Essentia Health. This is Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Super Talk. Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Super Talk 1270, you're tuned to Talk of the Town. I'm Steve Bach along with Dr. Kevin Carls, gastroenterologist from Essentia Health. And, okay, we talked about bowel movements a little bit, but what are some of the most common things that people come in about? You know, hey, I've got this going on, or I've got an ailment, or I think something might be up. What are some of the common cases that you have to deal with as a gastroenterologist at Essentia?
Well, a lot of these things, again, are changes that we might notice that differ from our normal day-to-day. You know, heartburn is a really common one. Heartburn, bloating, changes in our appetite. These are really common everyday things. And of course, changes in our bowel movements. Any unusual pain in the abdomen that we have, we'll also, as gastroenterologists, deal with issues with the liver as well. It might not be a symptom that gets you in to see us. It might be your doctor has noticed a change in your liver tests or other labs that perhaps even anemia that winds up being a reason that people come in to see us.
Okay, connect the dots for our listeners mm-hmm. out there, because a lot of people don't think of GI and GI tract as liver. Mm-hmm. But things that go into help digestion, you know, I can also think of the pancreas, and there's a role for the appendix, all the things that play into that entire system, mm-hmm. that's all interconnected, and that's all under your purvey.
Absolutely. I'll usually summarize it as we work on one end of the digestive tract to the other, and the different organs that are attached along the way. Our liver absolutely is one of those main organs, pancreas as well. I don't particularly specialize in the pancreas as well as some of my partners do, but certainly there are a lot of conditions that involve that also.
So when you're looking at some of the other issues, you mentioned, you know, heartburn, and that seems to be a common one. In the past, a lot of it's been, well, take a pill. That methodology is kind of changing recently because they're finding some of the medications, maybe you shouldn't be on them for a long term.
Sure. Well, and a good rule of thumb is that no medicine should necessarily be trusted as something that we just get put on and stay on for life. Now, there are some of our main medicines that we use to deal with things like heartburn, medicines we call PPIs, proton pump inhibitors, like omeprazole and pantoprazole. Gotten a bad rap over the years, and some of that actually has been based on some very poorly done or incorrect studies from 15, 20 years ago, where we have all of this concern that they could cause anything from problems with our bones, like osteoporosis, to kidney dysfunction, to blood clots and strokes, possibly even things like dementia. I get people that come in to see me about this all the time that are extremely concerned about this, and they want to avoid these medications at all costs. Well, truthfully, the studies that supposedly showed that these things happen never actually showed that these things happen, and a lot of them have been disproven over the years as well. But the bottom line is, if we have a condition that we know can be helped by these medications, we want you to be on these until we feel that it's safe to try to come off of them. And that period might be a lot shorter than you think.
Is that one of the dangers when medications shift from a prescription to an over-the-counter?
Absolutely. And there are, you know, great examples of these are medicines like omeprazole or Prilosec, as some folks know it. You know, you'll have all of this availability, and you'll see a warning on the back of the box: only take for 14 days or talk to your doctor. A lot of people don't.
A lot of people don't talk to the doctor.
Well, they don't. And if you're taking one of these pills and you feel great, you might just say, hey, as long as I take this, I'm going to be fine. I don't need to bother my doctor with this. But what are you treating, and what is it that was feeling bad in the first place? And is it possible that there could be something going on that your doctor should hear about and maybe look into further? You know, things like reflux can put you at risk for cancers if we're not careful about them. And that's why it's always important to make sure that, your doctor, you and your doctor, have a dialogue about these symptoms.
And that's one of the dangers, too, because people will treat, you know, when they're try to treat themselves, they'll treat a symptom and not the root cause of something quite often. When you're looking at, you know, an acid reflux issue, how much of it or how often does it come down to sitting down with a patient and some minor lifestyle changes? Because things change, and I'm starting to figure this out myself, as we get older, you know, I can't eat all the spicy food I used to eat, or, you know, some different foods I need to add into my palate, maybe not drink as much caffeine. A lot of simple lifestyle changes can really play into a lot of the medications that people take.
Absolutely right. So much of what we do in gastroenterology wouldn't exist if it weren't for things we do with our lifestyle. Reflux as a phenomenon is mostly an issue related to how we eat. It's not because we make too much acid. It's not because there's necessarily something anatomically wrong with us. It's something that happens because we've, you know, over time eaten meals that are too large, eaten meals that are too close to bedtime, and these things all lead to that increased pressure in the stomach that can force that acid up into our esophagus and cause the injury that's there. And same thing with problems with bowel movements that we see folks for. You know, the typical diet that we have around here, it's just more convenient to avoid fiber, and truthfully our colon relies on fiber to maintain normal function throughout the day,
but in moderation, because
to some degree
too much of anything can be a little bad. And I recently had a colonoscopy that had to be aborted because I had too much fiber in my system. So yeah, again, in moderation, but simple lifestyle change.
Absolutely. And, you know, lifestyle changes are part of what we do. You know, getting back to the issue with these medications like omeprazole. Sure, using these medicines are great to heal injury from the reflux itself, but they don't actually prevent the reflux. They heal the injury. Well, if we make some of these necessary changes in how we eat, it reduces the reflux.
How cognizant do people need to be of age, because things change as you get older? The things I ate when I was 20 are not the things I should be eating when I'm 50.
You know, I try and focus on that type of thing with patients in my practice a lot, in that it doesn't necessarily always matter what we eat as much as how we eat and the timing and so on. But, you know, sometimes there are changes that occur in, you know, how things move through us as we age, and, you know, how things like constipation can affect even upper digestive symptoms, and certainly our activity levels can also have an effect on how we feel when we eat certain things.
It could be as simple too as with acid reflux, is don't lay down after you take a, you know, take a nap after you eat a meal, because your acid's working and that can cause it as well. So
definitely,
some simple things.
Definitely.
This is Talk of the Town. We're talking with Dr. Kevin Carls of Essentia Health on Super Talk 1270.
Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Super Talk 1270, you're tuned to Talk of the Town. I'm Steve Bakken, along with Dr. Kevin Carls from Essentia Health, the gastroenterologist. And, all right, we talked a lot about the acid reflux, because usually when you think, or most people when they have an issue, it's either the front end or the back end. And we talked about the front end, so let's talk a little bit about the back end.
Sure.
One of the things that are out there that maybe a lot of people don't understand is irritable bowel syndrome, IBS. That can come from a lot of different places.
Yeah. Well, and there's probably a number of different conditions that we think of as IBS.
Is it kind of an umbrella term for a lot of things?
It is to a degree. You know, we we kind of typically think of IBS as being some kind of change in your normal bowel pattern that's associated with some type of abdominal pain. Usually we'll see some type of relationship between the pain and the meals that we eat, as well as pain around the time of bowel movements as well. But typically does not involve inflammation of the body or of the digestive tract, does not involve things like weight loss or fevers or bleeding, and so these are some of the things that separate it from the concept of inflammatory bowel diseases, which is something else that we specialize
in. So that's IBD.
IBD.
Okay, yep. So very different. So I'm imagining different course of treatment as well. Yeah,
definitely different course of treatment. Believe it or not, symptoms can be similar in these to some degree. Whereas with things like irritable bowel, the solution is usually making sure that we've got appropriate amounts of fiber and fluids in our daily routine. With inflammatory bowel disease, you have a condition where your immune system is essentially run amok and it's attacking your digestive tract, causing problems that a simple dietary change is not going to fix. You need something to actually deal with that overactive immune system that's attacking.
So one of the things that pops into my mind is like Crohn's disease. Would that fall under that category?
Absolutely. Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis are our two major types of inflammatory bowel disease. And we deal with them in similar ways. We diagnose these through colonoscopy and sometimes upper endoscopy, depending on the patient. And then we use medications to try to take this overactive inflammation and reduce it to actually get the immune system to back off and leave the digestive tract alone so we can restore some of that normal function.
So with a Crohn's, that's kind of a little bit of a different systemic issue. With ulcerative colitis, people talk about, well, I got a touch of colitis all the time. Explain that for our listeners.
Well, ulcerative colitis is just that. It is an inflammatory disease that specifically affects the colon or the lining of the colon itself.
But there's colitis and then there's ulcerative colitis,
sure.
And that's
sure.
A much more serious condition.
Yeah. Colitis in general is just a term that means some inflammation of the colon. In fact, Crohn's disease can decide to just show up in the colon, and then we have Crohn's colitis. But there are also types of colitis caused by infections, like bacteria like C. difficile. We've got types of colitis that can be caused by problems with blood flow to our colon, one we call ischemic colitis, and so on. So a lot of different forms of inflammation and damage of the colon that can occur, and we treat them all differently.
So now when things get ulcerative and people think about a peptic ulcer or ulcerative colitis, that's a much more serious condition.
Definitely. And ulcerative colitis is just that. This inflammation can literally cause ulcers of the entire lining of the colon, and this can lead to bleeding, diarrhea, pain, and even things that affect other parts of the body, weight loss, and so on. There can even be symptoms that exist outside of the digestive tract because of this intense inflammation, like joint pains or rashes, and so on. And so it's always good for you to have a gastrointestinal specialist like myself to really stay on top of these things.
What are the typical ways, because I think in endoscopy, or how do you diagnose some of those conditions?
As a gastroenterologist, I'm a specialist in general endoscopy of the digestive tract. And the two main ones are the one we refer to as an upper endoscopy, or an EGD, with a tiny camera that goes through the mouth, down through the esophagus into the stomach and the first part of our small intestine. The other scope that we specialize in is colonoscopy. And, of course, that's going in the other end and going up through the entire colon and usually seeing the lower end of the small intestine. And these procedures are done so that we can look to see, does this lining of our digestive tract appear normal and healthy the way it's supposed to? Sometimes it may look normal, and we can only find out that there is inflammation in that tissue by taking little samples or biopsies of the tissue while we're in there.
And you usually think about that with polyps.
Absolutely. And a polyp, of course, is something that sticks out a little more. It's certainly something that is different from the surrounding tissue. A polyp is a growth in the digestive tract, usually the colon that we think of, that has the potential to keep growing abnormally over time and eventually become a cancer. All colon cancer starts out as a polyp. Not all polyps, of course, have the potential for turning into cancer later on, but it's important that we realize that we all have the potential to make these things, particularly in our colon, and it's important to look for them from time to time.
So what are some of the, because the guidelines have changed recently and they've changed multiple times as far as what age should you start getting a colonoscopy, what age should you, the frequency of your colonoscopy, are there other underlying conditions? That's all really changed recently.
Yeah. Well, and we've always known for a while that people in general will have a tendency to start making these small precancerous growths we call polyps around age 50. And that's when we would always start looking for them. But we noticed that there were some people that would develop colon cancers earlier in life. And we've always tried to look for ways to predict this or ways to catch these earlier. And so about 7 years ago, all the gastrointestinal societies got together and said, hey, you know what? We need to move this back. We started making the screening age 45, where we start everybody off. And this doesn't mean, yeah, you got the symptoms, you got belly pain, changes in your bowel movements, you should think of a colonoscopy. No, this is, if you're feeling normal and healthy, still, age 45, start thinking about getting those colonoscopies done because we expect you may have some of these polyps there.
And it's just, you know, like with women with breast cancer and breast screenings, it's good preventative medicine. And that's a care plan that you need to craft with your physician and make sure that you have a plan of care. Because when I was first told, it's like, oh, nope, you need to be a little bit earlier and you... Okay. But it took me a little by surprise because the criteria changed.
Yeah. And if there is anything that suggests you could be at an increased risk of colon cancer, let's say you've got multiple family members that have had precancerous polyps. If you've got anybody in your family that you're aware of that's had colon cancer, it doesn't just matter if it's a sibling, a parent, or a child of yours before the age of 60, like it always traditionally has been. But if you have anybody in the family that's had colon cancer, you may need to have that first colonoscopy earlier, perhaps at age 40 or earlier than that.
We're talking with Dr. Kevin Carls, Essentia GI doc over at Essentia Health. This is Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Talk 1270.
Welcome back to Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Super Talk 1270, your tooth to talk of the town. I'm Steve Bakken along with Dr. Kevin Carls, Essentia Health, the gastroenterologist. And we're talking about screenings. Okay, colonoscopy, endoscopy, those are just a couple. There are other options now, and the medical field is expanding greatly. For somebody, who would be a candidate? Because we talked about if you have conditions that would warrant an earlier screening or an earlier colonoscopy, but there are some other options out there as well.
Absolutely. Now, if we think that there's an increased risk of colon cancer, then really colonoscopy is the gold standard. But just everyday folks with no symptoms, perfectly healthy, age 45, is colonoscopy my only option? Actually, it's not. You know, we've got, most folks have seen commercials for products like Cologuard out there, where you send in stool, it gets checked out, they check it for signs of blood, for different genetic markers of polyp and tumor cells, and they send you a result back. And you can get this done at age 45 as well as an option. And whereas a colonoscopy, you get that, and it's normal. You've got 10 years before you have to worry about it again. With a Cologuard, if you do that, you could have 3 years before you need to do that again or any other type of screening. The thing to keep in mind about Cologuard is that it is a screening test that's meant to cast a broad net. It can sometimes have false positives and false negatives. It's also only meant for people that are at the lowest risk of colon cancer. If we've got somebody that has that family history or has symptoms going on, these folks actually don't qualify for Cologuard because Cologuard actually wasn't designed to be effective in those circumstances. If you've ever had precancerous polyps, you actually don't qualify for Cologuard. And folks need to be aware of that.
Again, always talk to your physician and make sure that you have a plan of health with your physician, what's best for you. We talked about diet and nutrition a little bit already, but again, can't stress enough fiber and having a good diet, cutting out some of the things that you shouldn't be, all play a big role in having proper GI health. As far as preventative care, and we talked about some of the early screenings and stuff, but what are some of the things people need to be cognizant of to try to mitigate some of the risk? If you don't have some of the family history or pre-existing conditions, what's just good common practices?
Well, it kind of some of the stuff that we touched on already, you know, making sure we're paying attention to the timing and the size of our meals. Sometimes the content of our meals is important. We already talked about fiber, but there are things like, you know, omega-3 fatty acids that we know can be helpful for things like inflammation. And not having too much red meat in the diet can sometimes be beneficial as well. You know, physical activity is also a big one, surprisingly helpful for a lot of gastrointestinal issues that we deal with. And of course, things like smoking are bad for multiple different systems of our digestive tract. And of course, as a physician that specializes in liver health like myself, alcohol is another one of these things we need to be moderating, realizing that it can put a burden on certain parts of our digestive tract.
All right, I mentioned the screening criteria changing a little bit. What else has changed? What, medicine is always advancing. What are some of the advancements or some of the exciting things on the horizon for gastroenterology?
Well, we've just got so many different categories of or sections of gastroenterology where we're seeing advances these days. Inflammatory bowel disease has always been kind of a specialty of mine where we used to have just a small handful of medicines we could pick from to try to help corral that overactive immune system in the past. Now we're getting to the point where we have dozens of different medicines that allow us to really customize that treatment to an individual patient's disease, which is not necessarily going to be exactly the same as everybody else's. We can monitor how those medicines are working. We even have liver diseases where we've never had treatments before, things like what we used to refer to as fatty liver disease, which we now know as metabolic dysfunction associated liver disease. We never had any medicines for this, and now we're seeing great medicines that that can actually reduce our risk of developing liver damage over time.
I've seen a lot of different changes because of COVID. What are some of the impacts that COVID may have had in the GI tract, or as people have been exposed to that, or some of the different changes in medicine when it comes to gastroenterology?
You know, it's interesting. We did see a lot of issues regarding COVID early on. You know, certainly a lot of problems with IBS as a result or following courses of infections with COVID. It was very difficult sometimes with these patients of ours with inflammatory disease that were on immune suppressing medications when we were dealing with this crazy pandemic and trying to navigate with that. But you know, for the most part now we don't see a lot of residual issues due to COVID.
What's the best advice you give somebody who's experiencing something that, I can just tough it out? What do you tell patients or what do you tell our listeners out there that might have an issue?
Always, you never really want to.
Don't assume, for one.
Don't assume that what's going on is just something you got to live with. You know, document what's happening with you. I bring up the term journaling. You know, keep an eye on how you're feeling day to day. You know, look for some of these patterns and what's going on. Don't be afraid to talk with somebody about it. And you can always start with your primary care doctor. You know, as a gastroenterologist, I specialize in this stuff, but your primary care doctors and primary care providers are great for recognizing some of these things and helping you see stuff that could be concerning or really needs to be looked into more.
And, you know, unlike a lot of other physicians where you go to an appointment, there's some prep work, or at least, you know, knowing what to bring to the table when you go for a GI appointment.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And again, the issue of journaling that I mentioned there, see how you're feeling on a day-to-day basis. Are there any particular foods that tend to bother you? Is there a timing that you can notice? Is morning worse for you? Are you having problems in the middle of the night? Are you losing weight when you're not trying to? These kind of things, just keep track of those. And then this will help you to organize your thoughts about what's going on in your body. This will allow you to communicate those to me or to your other physicians in a way that can really get to the heart of what's going on more quickly.
When it comes to gastroenterology, what do people need to know? What's your last word for GI tract health?
Never too early to consider how some little lifestyle changes can be very beneficial later. And this deals with diet and activity, like we mentioned. If something doesn't feel right, always talk it over with your primary care physician. And age does not necessarily matter. Don't take youth for granted. Just because you're young, there can still be issues that are very important. Talk to your doctors.
Dr. Kevin Carls, you can check him out over at Essentia Health. Make sure you stop by their website. A lot of great information on the Essentia Health website as well.
Yeah. I really have the privilege of being a part of a great team at Essentia within gastroenterology. It's myself, Dr. Doug Renton, Dr. Nick Batista, Lisa Murdoff and Amanda Wiles, our nurse practitioners, and Carly Schlosser, our physician assistant. We're just a wonderfully strong department that is really excited about the opportunities we have to provide care here in town.
Great team over there at Essentia Health. Dr. Kevin Carls, gastroenterology doc. This is Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
Talk of the Town, weekday mornings starting at 9 on Super Talk 1270 and the free Super Talk 1270 mobile app.